Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. My name is Jamie, and as always, I'm joined by my friend John. What is happening?
Not a whole lot, man. Just another day, another dollar, and we've got a really interesting case on. It's one that most people are familiar with. The name Charles Manson probably rings a bell, but we're going to take a little bit deeper dive into this one.
Yeah, I think the specific angle here is one that I was unaware of. I'd heard about Charles Manson, the crimes, the Manson family had committed, but this individual in particular is of interest to me, so I'm excited to share the story. Of course, I'd like to start out by giving thanks to a new 5-star review that came in over on Apple Podcasts. This comes from The Wild One NF33. It says, my name is Brandon, and this one episode is very hard, but very good. You guys are amazing, and thank you both of you for taking care of kids. I have 3 of my own. You make the world better. Nothing but love. Thank you so much. The title's Hey Guys, so I'm not sure which episode you're talking about. But yeah, some of them are really hard, especially the ones with kids, which hopefully won't be happening today.
Yeah. Also want to say thank you to Way to Lippy over on Patreon. They joined for the $25 level, so going to be getting a coffee cup out in the mail really soon for Way Too Lippy, and just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you for supporting the show. All of our Patreon members, you guys bless us so much. And to say thank you for that, we put out a bonus episode only available to our Patreon family once a month, and we give early ad-free episodes as well.
Gosh, and we're already almost through May again, so I'm going to start getting another one soon. This year is flying by. A lot of crime, very little time. And this is going to be, I don't know, there's a lot to get to here.
Why don't you get the ball rolling, man?
You'll be hard-pressed to find anybody that's interested in true crime who hasn't heard of Charles Manson. Even if you're not, I feel like the cultural impact that was made by the Manson family was well-known, and you at least recognize the name. But like I said, we're going to take a closer look into one of the members of the family today, just really quickly, and we've covered this before. Here's kind of a summary of their crimes. During July and August of 1969, Charles Manson instructed a handful of his followers, again, his disciples, essentially, to kill 9 people. Gary Hinman, pregnant actress Sharon Tate, Abigail Folger, Jay Sebring, Wojciech Frykowski, Steve Parent, Leno LaBianca, Rosemary LaBianca, and Donald Shea. The people he allegedly had do these killings were Bobby Bisalili, Susan Adkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, Mary Brunner, Linda Kasabian, Tex Watson, Bruce Davis, Stephen Grogan, and the object of today's episode, Leslie Van Houten.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about Leslie Van Houten today. It's interesting and some updates to the case recently, so really, really good timing. Van Houten was born on August 23rd, 1949, in the Los Angeles suburb of Altadena. She grew up in a middle-class, church-going family with parents named Paul and Jane. She had an older brother. She had 2 younger siblings who were both adopted from Korea. And Van Houten was just a pretty typical girl. She was the homecoming queen at her high school. She was very pretty. Just like, I don't know, all-American girl, basically. When Van Houten was 14 years old, her parents decided to get divorced. And today in 2025, I mean, I feel like half of my friends are divorced, and my kids have friends whose parents are divorced. It's not uncommon, but back then it was definitely uncommon. And this devastated Van Houten. She started trying to cope with this devastation by experimenting with drugs. And at first, it was just marijuana, hash, but by the time she was 15 years old, she had moved on to LSD. It's a pretty hard drug for a 15-year-old.
It is. And in the mid-60s, this is kind of the when LSD was taken off. So it was readily available and kind of all the rage with people looking to experiment with drugs. At 17 years old, Van Houten ran away from home with her boyfriend to the hot Ashbury area of San Francisco. She came home, however, to finish high school in 1967. It was around that time that Van Houten discovered that she was pregnant, and her mother was horrified by this. Again, they were a pretty strictly Christian family or religious family. Jane brought a woman up from Mexico to perform an illegal abortion in Van Houten's room. Again, something that was a lot less, well, abortion was much less legal back then. And a lot of it was happening illegally and dangerously in these ways. And that's what happened with Van Houten. She said, "My mom told me to just be quiet and not wake my brother or sister during this medical procedure happening in her bedroom." Her mom then made her go and bury the fetus in the backyard herself. So we talked about divorce, and that's certainly traumatic for a young person, but burying a child that you have been forced by your mother to abort in your room is a whole other level of trauma.
Just awful to hear the details of that. Van Houten turned 19 in the summer of 1968 and spent a few months in a commune in Northern California. And that's where she met Catherine Scher and Bobby Beausoleil. Now, Scher started telling Van Houten about a man named Charles Manson. She called him Christ-like and had all the answers that they were looking for, talking about Charles. When Scher left to join Manson's commune, Van Houten followed. She called her mother and told her that she was being dropped off and that she would not be contacting her again. When they arrived at the commune, they gave over full control to Manson. He renamed everybody with nicknames and decided that they had to be under his control. He would control when they would eat, when they would sleep, when they would have sex, and who to have sex with. He also controlled the LSD. He would even give his followers larger doses than he took himself. Van Houten said that she became saturated in acid and could not grasp the existence of those living in a non-psychedelic reality. So it sounds like she's just high on LSD all the time. That is her new normal.
And I think he's giving them more, right, so that they can be, I don't know, he's more present of mind and more able to have control if he's not as high as they are, I guess. In August of 1968, Van Houten and the rest of the Manson family lived at The Spawn, which is a ranch on the outskirts of L.A. It was an abandoned movie set where old westerns had once been filmed, run by an old man who was hard of hearing. Manson had decided that Van Houten belonged to Bobby Beausoleil, and she was considered a leader in the family. Van Houten would later say, "All he did was listen to the Beatles' White Album and read Revelations," being the book of Revelation from the Bible. And soon, Manson's lectures started to get darker and darker. I mean, he called it the Manson family. This is a cult, and he is the leader. He started convincing them that there was a worldwide race war between black and white people that would be coming soon. Manson thought that he had to assist in getting this war started, so he started orchestrating the murders we discussed earlier. He was going to try to frame some members of the Black Panthers and really trying to be the person who kicks off this race war, which he was, for lack of a better term, trying to prophesy to his followers.
On the night of August 8th, 1969, that's when she and this large group of people drove to the Spawn Ranch to a home that was lived in by Sharon Tate. And I'm sure most people are familiar with that name. If you're not, she was the wife of a film director. She was also 9 or 8 months pregnant, and this was like a beauty queen, right? She was very well known, Jamie. Is that correct?
Yeah, she was an actress and known in Hollywood. And this is, anytime you listen or list the crimes of the Manson family, her name's probably the most notable.
So, like I said, she was 8.5 months pregnant. She had guests spending the night that we're talking about, and her husband was filming in Europe, so he was gone. The family members, that being the cult, I guess you could say, or the commune, broke in and brutally murdered Sharon, Abigail Fogler, Jay Sebring, Wojcik Frykowski and Steve Parent. It was thought that they targeted that house because it had been recently rented by the music producer Terry Meckler. Van Houten was not part of that attack, and court papers show that she felt left out and wanted to join in on the next round of violence. Manson was also allegedly not happy with how sloppy the murders were of the Tate house, so he told his followers to try again and be even more gruesome this time. On August the 9th, 1969, that's when Van Houten, Manson, and the rest of the commune all drove to the house of Rosemary and Lino LaBlanca. Now, the LaBlancas were well-to-do people. They had just returned from a trip from Lake Isabella, and they had actually heard about the news of the Tate murders on the radio during their drive home just before they dropped off Rosemary's 21-year-old daughter. Then 39-year-old Rosemary and 44-year-old Lino went home.
Tex and Manson broke into the LaBlanca house and tied up the couple, telling them that if they didn't move, they would be fine, since they were only there to rob the place. Of course, we know from Manson's earlier commands that this wasn't necessarily true. So Manson left with Kasabian, Atkins, and Grogan with him. Tex told Krenwinkel and Van Houten, I hope you're keeping up with all these names. Those are three members that stayed from the Manson family in this house, and they went to the kitchen and got knives. Then Van Houten and Krenwinkel took Rosemary into the bedroom, put a pillowcase over her head, and wrapped a lamp cord around her neck to keep the pillowcase in place. Tex started attacking Lino in the living room. Rosemary heard his screams and immediately started to call out for him. That's when Van Houten and Krenwinkel started stabbing Rosemary. Van Houten would testify in 71 that we started stabbing and cutting up the lady, end quote. Van Houten stabbed Rosemary in the lower back around 16 times. The very next day, Rosemary's son Frank came home around 8 p.m. The boat was still hitched to the car, so he knew they had gotten back from vacation, but that something was probably wrong. All the shades were drawn, the kitchen light was on, so he called his sister, who came over with her boyfriend, and they all decided to go into the house together in case something was going on. Lino was on his back in the living room with a pillowcase over his face. He had a knife stuck in his neck, a carving fork in his stomach, and the word war was carved into his abdomen. They left the house immediately, running to a neighbor's house to call the police, and pretty quickly, just a few months later, Van Houten was arrested on November 25th of 1969.
Leslie Van Houten was charged with first-degree murder in the LaBlanca murders. Manson was also accused of orchestrating both the Tate and LaBlanca murders. Van Houten and the other girls accused clearly did not take the court seriously because she was even giggling during testimony about the victims. And Jamie, you and I both know that if you're a jury member and you see one of the plaintiffs giggling as they talk about a murder victim, you can almost assuredly realize that that's not going to bode well.
It's not. And that's kind of, I think, what made this group so scary, is doing things like that. They were so unpredictable, and you didn't know. I mean, didn't really know what their motive was at the time. He told his followers he was wanting to start this race war, but as far as we knew, they were just killing people for fun, and being that unpredictable was super intimidating.
She would later claim that during the trial, she was actually high on LSD, that someone had given that to her before the trial, but
wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? Van Houten dismissed three different defense lawyers for claiming her actions were because of the Mansons' control over her. So to have also three different attorneys or four different attorneys to represent you, it's a lot.
And I mean, that's a defense, right? To claim that somebody had some kind of mental control over you. And that's a viable defense that she was turning away. One of her attorneys, whose name was Ira Reiner, said, I tried to separate Leslie from the other defendants. She was very young, a cultist under the thrall of a cult leader. That was going to be my defense, which, end quote. But that's, I think, a very appropriate defense. Obviously, Manson didn't like this approach. And he, with the power he had over Leslie, she just kept rejecting that. Ira went and visited Leslie in jail after Manson no longer approved of him and she changed her attitude toward him. She had once been friendly, but was now cold. Three of the Manson female disciples had shown up for the meeting and sat in a semicircle behind Ira. So, obviously, again, this is more unpredictable, off-the-cuff, intimidating behavior. Ira said he was afraid that they were going to follow him home, so he asked a sheriff's captain to detain them while he left the jail. And he said, it's not paranoia. Paranoia is only an unreasonable suspicion. They killed enough people that when they threatened you, you took it seriously. And the next day, I went to court and said, my client would like a substitution, end quote. And I do not blame him one bit.
So in July 1970, 5 weeks into the trial, there was a man named Ronald Hughes that signed on without pay to represent Van Houten. And we have to talk about this guy. So Manson wanted Hughes to represent him as well.
Strike one. If Manson wants you around, that's a knock against you already.
Right. So this clearly came as a surprise to everyone. So Hughes, a little bit of background on this guy and his law journey, if you will. He had only passed the bar 10 months before this, and he had failed the bar 3 times before he finally passed it. Now, look, I probably couldn't pass the bar. Also, to be fair, I haven't studied, but I feel like even with a lot of studying, it's a hard test.
It is, for good reason.
Not everyone can be an attorney.
Absolutely.
But for if your life is on the line here, because this is a case where the death penalty was on the line, wouldn't you want an attorney with some gray hair who's, you know, kind of been there, done that?
Absolutely, 100%.
He was Manson's, quote, legal runner, and he had never tried a case, let alone a murder trial. I mean, this dude couldn't get you out of a parking ticket before he was thrown into this case. He was known as the hippie lawyer. He had a very unkempt beard. He wore a love bead necklace to court. I mean, this is like my cousin Vinny, but like a hippie version of that.
Yeah.
So this guy was just hot mess express. He actually slept on a mattress in a 2-car garage with holes in the roof. You know, he hadn't been working as a lawyer long, so he's not making lawyer money. He actually hung his UCLA law degree on the wall that was decorated in like psychedelic colors. So, I mean, just think of the epitome of hippie and then let him have just passed the bar exam. And this is who you are using as your defense attorney.
And I'm sure when all this came out, UCLA really wanted that law degree to come down. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about Hughes's background and how he ended up being the Manson's lawyer. I would say that Ronald Hughes was somewhat of an enigma. People would say he was nice enough. He was friendly. Growing up, he was in a conservative family who served the Army in Korea. He was an Army veteran himself. After his service, he drifted into LA and became a part of the counterculture. So protesting a lot of things. This was a time when people were really out there shouting a lot, and I mean, if you don't know about the American 60s and 70s, you should go watch Forrest Gump. When he was appointed, Hughes had just turned 35 years old, and like John said, had only passed the bar earlier that year. He had actually socialized with Charles Manson before he was arrested, so Manson likely thought that he was somebody who could be manipulated and who he could have control over. And if he could have control over an attorney, that's even more power for Manson. But Hughes had no clue what he was doing. He only had 2 ties. One was a Mickey Mouse tie, and the other one had a naked lady on it, neither of which is going to be welcome in a murder trial. The judge told him he had to wear a jacket in court, so he borrowed one from a reporter, and it was way too small on him. He started buying discount suits from auctions at MGM, and he would show off the names of the actors inside it who had worn the suit in movies.
I mean, I joked about My Cousin Vinny, but my God, this is like right out of the script. Is this where they got the idea?
This may have been Vinny's suit. I'm not sure. At one point, he was held in contempt for saying the S word. So in just shouting expletives in regular conversation. The judge gave him a choice of paying $75 or staying the night in jail. He chose the night in jail, saying, "I'm a pauper. It was a good experience. I would have paid another $75 just to go through it."
Wow. I mean, if you're living on the top of your car in a roof that leaks, I mean, if it was raining that night, that's a good deal.
Yeah, three hots and a cot, right? That's what he was looking forward to.
Probably the first time he had a shower in who knows how long. So, but this guy actually, he learned on the job, and he eventually skillfully questioned a fingerprint expert and established Van Houten's prints were never found at the La Bianca home. This is not the kind of expert cross-witnessing that I would have expected out of a guy who had never tried a murder. But he also cross-examined and the state star witness, Linda Casaban, and asked her some very detailed questions about drug and drug use as a way to discredit her. As the trial was nearing its end, Van Houten was insisting that she be able to testify. Manson had seemingly told all the women to testify and to say that he had no control over them, even though they had all carved the X into their forehead after he did the same thing. Is this Manson's way of trying to do some self-preservation? Like, no, they're on their own. I'm not the one responsible here.
Yeah, if he doesn't have control over them, that means they did this on their own and he's not culpable.
Hughes thought that Van Houten had a shot at being acquitted, but he thought that that shot would go out the window if she ever took the stand. So the judge did say Van Houten had the right to testify, and Hughes' response to the judge was, "Your Honor, I refuse to take part in any proceedings where I am forced to push a client out the window. He knows if she gets up to testify, it's not going to be good. I mean, she's already... Now we know she's probably high on LSD during this whole time, and he knows it's not a good idea."
And if he knows it, then it seems pretty obvious because he's still a newbie.
Yep. So there is one person in the courtroom who remembers that Manson was furious at Hughes for going against him and not wanting Van Houten to testify. They even said that Manson got irate, pointed at Hughes and said, "Attorney, I don't ever want to see you in this courtroom again." So Manson just kind of going ballistic during the trial.
Yeah, and knowing how much violence is here, that's not taken as an idle threat, I wouldn't think. The judge ordered a 10-day recess so that attorneys could prepare their closing arguments. Hughes told a reporter that he planned on spending this recess going to a love-in at the Sespe Hot Springs in Los Padres National Forest. He was bringing along transcripts to study while he was camping. Hughes caught a ride with two teenage friends. Again, he's a 35-year-old man with teenage friends. Weird. And they rode in a Volkswagen out to the camping area. As torrential rain poured on the area, there were mudslides. The roads were washed out. The teens end up hitchhiking out of the camping area, but Hughes stayed. When court resumed on November 30th of 1970, Hughes wasn't there. He was still out in the woods somewhere.
Van Houten had a new attorney appointed quickly who had to scramble to learn this case. All four were convicted of murder, but Hughes was still missing. A retired park ranger told a newspaper that he was camping in the Hot Springs area in early 1971 when he encountered a man and woman who needed a ride. They had allegedly said that they were looking for Ronald Hughes. The young woman said that he was her boyfriend and invited the ranger to party with them, but he declined. He said they also had X's on their foreheads, so this is most likely more folks associated with Manson. 4 months after Hughes disappeared, trout fishermen found a badly decomposed body wedged between boulders in a remote, rocky area a few miles from the Sepps Hot Springs. Dental X-rays confirmed that it was, in fact, Ronald Hughes. There was no immediate sign of foul play, but the condition of the body made it almost impossible to know for sure the meaning or the cause behind his death. There was no hard evidence to prove the family had anything to do with Hughes' death, but one disciple, Sandra Good, claimed in a documentary that Hughes was the first retaliation murder. On the other hand, people who knew the area knew flash floods and treacherous rains would often make it very hard to to walk in there and lose your footing and fall if that was happening. But Jamie, I think this is probably a retaliation. What do you think?
Yeah, I honestly think this could go either way. For them to say it's a retaliation killing, I think could just be an intimidation technique. He stayed out there when it was already treacherous, so he very well may have died on his own. But we also known that this poop was looking for him. And for them to be out there and people to say, we're looking for Ronald Hughes, I think does give credence to the idea that he was killed and sought out to be killed after he was yelled at Manson and then disappeared. Van Houten was sentenced to death to be executed. She was the youngest woman ever condemned to death in the state of California. At the time, there was not even a death row for female inmates, so one had to be built. But just 2 years later, the California Supreme Court removed the death penalty in the state and commuted all death sentences to life in prison. Van Houten would be eligible for parole after serving just 7 years. John, how do we go from death sentence to 7 years?
I genuinely do not understand.
I really don't either. Before that, in 1977, she was granted a retrial due to failure to declare a mistrial when her attorney went missing. There's obviously ineffective counsel is a reason for appeal. Absent counsel, I think, should be as well. So in this new trial, her defense argued that Van Houten's capacity for rational thought was diminished by excessive LSD use and Manson's influence. So here, they got to argue that she was under the influence of Charles Manson, which she prevented previous attorneys from doing. The result of this trial was a hung jury, and in her second retrial, she would again be found guilty of first-degree murder and given a life sentence with eligibility for parole.
So in the early 1970s, Van Houten and a couple of the other ladies worked with a social worker in prison who wanted to help them reestablish their identities after breaking away from the cult. Two of the women, dude, were led to believe that in the upcoming race war, they would grow wings and become fairies. And they, like, in their minds, legitimately believed that. I think when I read about this, it makes me think of MK Ultra.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, there was reason to believe that Manson was involved in that, right?
Right, right.
And then also their LSD use. It's very, very interesting. But anyway, the social workers saw that all three women, they were victims. They were victims of Manson, and they lobbied for an early release for all these victims. So in the years that followed, Van Houten would be in a constant back and forth with parole boards and California governors. In 2013, she was denied parole for the 20th time. That has to be, you know, if you're in a better mental spot at that time, and that has to be just so disheartening and almost like a formality. You're going and you know nothing good could be expected after this.
And there has to be a breaking point. There has to be that one time where it's like you're denied this time and then you feel like all hope is lost. And maybe she kept going through it after that. Maybe she wasn't there yet. But yeah, it has to be one of the most disheartening processes that you can have.
I would imagine at some point you just stop trying. You stop trying. And the commissioner at that most recent hearing said that she failed to explain how someone of her good background and intelligence could have committed such a cruel and atrocious murder. In 2016, there was a two-person panel who recommended granting Van Houten's parole request, but at the time, a governor named Jerry Brown vetoed the release, saying, quote, both her role in these extraordinarily brutal crimes and her inability to explain her willing participation in such horrific violence cannot be overlooked and lead me to believe she remains an unacceptable risk to society if released, end quote.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll get into this later on whether or not she was a risk, how should people who are manipulated be held accountable, but I feel like in 2016, it's pretty tone deaf for him to be talking this way about somebody who was widely considered a victim, and that's part of why I wanted to do this case, is there's a lot of, I don't know, nuances in the people that were with Manson, their roles, and how much control they actually have. While she was in prison, Van Houten was active in self-help and substance abuse programs. She took on volunteer work and maintained an exemplary disciplinary record in prison. While she was there, she earned both a bachelor's and master's degree and completed vocational training with the hopes of returning to society. She's long since renounced the Manson. She has expressed remorse for her crimes. At the 2013 parole hearing, she argued that her value system was completely different from what it had been in 1972. She also expressed that she was upset Manson did not own up to his role in the murders before he passed away in 2017. Van Houten has written several short stories, edited the prison newspaper, and did some secretarial work in the prison. While in prison, she also married a former prisoner. Her lawyer has said she had a long job of detaching herself from the cult mentally and accepting responsibility for her crimes. It took her a long time. She had decades of therapy, so she felt guilt and deep remorse, end quote.
In 2017, the parole board again recommended her request be granted, saying that Van Houten had radically changed her life in the last 40 years, but the governor again denied that one. Her legal team fought that decision, and the judge upheld the governor's veto, saying basically, unless the inmate can demonstrate that there is no evidence to support the governor's conclusion that the inmate is a current danger to public safety, then the petition will fail and will not be overturned. So it's basically like, you know, when I think of court as like just a grown-up version of what kids do, like, no, I'm not. Well, prove it. I can't prove it. So in January 2019, during her 22nd parole hearing, Van Houten was recommended for parole again. In June, though, Governor Newsom overruled the board's recommendation, saying that she is still a danger to society and that she still had the potential for future violence. So this kind of thing goes back and forth, back and forth. The same thing basically happened again in 2021, but then in 2023, a California Court of Appeals in Los Angeles set aside Newsom's denial. Newsom said that he would not file an appeal, and that paved the way for Van Houten's release.
And at this point, she's 71 years old. So I think at some point in time, you have to look at her age and ask whether or not she's a threat to society.
I would think don't let her work in a nursing home or in a daycare, and we're good.
I think we're good. I think people can protect themselves pretty much otherwise. Van Houten was released on parole on July 11th, 2023, after serving 52 years in prison. She was transferred to a transitional living facility while subject to parole supervision. Her parole would last up to a maximum of 3 years, which is still ongoing. The victim's relatives were very frustrated that she was released. Sharon Tate's sister publicly said, "Is she a nice girl? No. Is she an animal? I think she was then, and I fear she still is." Similar sentiments came from the LaBiaca family, where they felt like since they don't have their parents around, then she should not be able to be around an open society. The original prosecutor on the case says all of them should have been executed back in 1971, and I asked for the death penalty. Van Houten's attorney would reply by saying, from a legal standpoint, this is a very important case because it underscores that the law must be applied even-handedly, regardless of an inmate's notoriety. Today, as far as we know, she's still navigating life under supervision after she was released after 50 years in prison. She, at this point, she did complete degrees. She's learning to job hunt. She's learning to buy things without cash. She's learning really how the world works outside of the prison walls, because while she was outside before then, she was pretty much dominated by Manson and didn't do a lot of thinking on her own, I don't think. So, John, I want to ask you, what do you think about her being paroled? It is such an odd situation where she was... I mean, it was very violent crimes that were committed. We do know that that type of control over people exists in cults. Where's the balance?
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, I feel like I'm going to be a curmudgeon, but you do the crime, you do the time. I mean, that's been the mantra my whole life. So let me ask you a question. At the end of the day, whether she was forced or drugged to the point that she didn't make a conscious decision, what was her involvement in the crimes? She was there. She held people down. She was involved, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't like she was in the car, didn't want to get out. They went in and did it, and then they all left. I mean, at one point, she even felt left out because she didn't get to go and do some of the mm-hmm. things that they were doing. So at some point, no matter the level of extent that you were involved, you were there on scene. You went in and did some awful, awful things. Was she a victim of Charles Manson? Probably, yes. At the same time, I don't know how you can ethically, where's the line that you draw in the sand? So she unfortunately was a victim herself, but I think she was also a participant, and okay. I don't feel like she should be out of jail.
Okay. That was my next question. Regardless of all that, is 50 years enough?
Yeah, man. I don't think so. What do you think?
Yeah. I think if we're saying she's guilty of murder and did so knowing what she was doing, then spending the rest of her life in prison is what should happen. And, you know, we've covered other cases where individuals have been victims of power situations, have been brainwashed to commit crimes. And, you know, I think it just depends so much on that individual situation. If you look at the power structure in the Manson family, yes, he did have control over them. But at what point was there a part in her therapy where that broke, where they saw she's finally able to be her own agent? If so, then that shows that maybe she didn't have the faculties to control herself. If that wasn't the case, I don't know.
I mean, hear me out, because this could be a crazy argument, but that line of thinking, you know, could a drunk make the argument that, hey, I was drunk when I drove and killed somebody. I didn't want to do that. I was under the influence. I mean, yeah.
I mean, that person drank on purpose.
Yeah.
So like it was their choice to end up in that situation. And you can make that argument. She joined Manson.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, was she kidnapped and forced to join the cult, or did she go leave the house that she was in? I mean, she was in a bad situation at home and she left and got into a worse situation. So yeah, I feel terrible for her. I think she was coerced. I think she was a victim in many ways, but at the same time, you face consequences for your actions.
Well, I was looking for this case while we were talking about this. Do you remember the case of Patty Hearst in California? She was kidnapped and held as a victim, ended up participating in some robberies where people were killed. But I mean, it was a situation where she was completely brainwashed and had no faculty. And I think at that time we kind of argued that she was a victim of the whole process.
Yeah.
So that's why I bring that up, to say every situation is different. I feel like we landed at a good place with Patty Hearst. And if I were to land somewhere with Leslie Van Houten, it would be that she willingly joined this family. She giggled in court. And if you want to attribute all that to brainwashing, have at it. But I think there was too much evidence of her being able to know what was happening for her to be completely without the ability to do this on her own.
Yeah. I feel like brainwashing and quicksand were things that we heard growing up was always a possibility. But now that I'm an adult, I'll never see it. I mean,
you don't. That's how it gets you.
I know, right? But
you
I've
don't
never
see it until you're in it.
I don't think I've been brainwashed. I don't know. Maybe I am. Who knows?
Would you know?
I don't know.
I don't think you would know. That's kind of the scary part. So, So what brought this up is that she is out of prison. She did get released a couple of years ago, and it was pretty controversial when it happened, and remains controversial as we now are looking at the Menendez brothers and their situation, which we haven't talked about those updates, but I think we probably should, as their sentence is likely being reduced as well.
Yeah.
But yeah,
we have a Patreon episode coming up. We should get into the Menendez brothers stuff there. So if you're interested in hearing our takes on that, please come check that out.
Absolutely, guys. We really appreciate you and hope you enjoyed this case.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.